Hi, everybody. This is Mark Chaffardini. Welcome back to the Go See Talk podcast. We are thrilled to be talking to our next guest, director, short film phenomenon, Travis Andrade, who did an amazing job with this film called Wesley. It's shocking. It's timely. It will hit you where it hurts, but I think people need to see this. So welcome to the show. Travis, we're super excited to speak to you.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks for having me.
I don't usually spend a lot of time watching shorts, not because I'm disinterested. It's just, there's only so much content out there. But when I saw this, I just, something hit me and I needed to speak to you. Before we get into it, let's get a little backstory on you. Where did the directing bug first bite you?
Well, I started in kind of working in camera department, actually in Nashville, Tennessee, on a variety of music videos and branded content and commercials and stuff when I was in college. So this would have been back in 2003, 2004. And sometime after that, after I graduated, I moved out to LA, went to film school, worked on set, worked on actually, did a bunch of reality television and music videos and independent projects, and small short films and stuff like that. And, at some point down the road, I just kind of started shooting my own stuff. And I was actually started doing a lot of music videos, directing music videos, and did some for some of the major labels and shot some commercials and did a short film years ago that no one will ever see and decided to I've been writing for a long time and writing scripts, and I just, I had a short story that I wanted to make. And these short films are just like, they're really a labor of love. You try to grab some people that have been in the industry for a while that can bring a lot of experience but can also wear, sort of many hats that are sort of jack of all trades, because you just don't have the resources, on a short film. And these things are hard to make. And it's really, like I said, a labor of love, because they're not necessarily the most, broad subjects or, suitable for all audiences. But the important approach, I think, as a filmmaker is just to be kind of honest and passionate about the subject matter that you're dealing with. And hopefully you'll be lucky enough to find people that will feel the same way about the project. And that was basically, we actually filmed this short about 2 months before COVID happened. So I was really lucky in that regard to actually just have people, on set and not have to worry about taking those extra precautions and all that stuff, which has been, a real struggle for the industry.
Well, yeah, as you kind of alluded to, and I've heard before, just because it's a short film doesn't mean the resources and execution is short. It's like filming a mission.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, you mentioned honest a second ago. Wesley, I think, is one of the most honest things I've ever seen. It talks about topics like guns and mental anxiety and things that kind of influence us, and it sort of dabbles in the periphery but doesn't really point a finger at anything. When did you start writing this, and when did the pieces start to come together?
I started writing it around Christmas time of 2000, I believe. I think it was 2019. Yeah, it was the end of 2019 I started writing it, and I sort of wrote the first draft kind of quick. I did one of what's called like a sort of vomit draft. It just kind of, comes out real fast. It's messy. You've got to fine tune it, work with it for a while afterward. But started talking to some friends, some confidants that I thought would maybe be interested in working on it with me. And, I was going to need their blood, sweat, and tears. And I mean, our resources were fairly small or fairly limited rather. But I was fortunate enough to find some people that wanted to do it. And I think the process of developing the script in total was probably a few months, but it took some time actually to secure some of the locations, because the story is about a kid who's kind of enamored with this troubled teen who has a 3D printed gun. The kid sees it, wants to get one of his own, and has some idle time. And it's kind of set up against a pervasive gun culture, American gun culture. So it's a middle-class kid, suburban kid, sort of trying to make it like anywhere town USA. Although when you watch the film, you can, you see some palm trees and stuff. I mean, it definitely kind of looks like Southern California, kind of that vibe. But it took some time to secure some of the locations given the subject matter. Like, for example, the school scenario sequence toward the end of the film. You know, as you can imagine, that kind of subject matter is really, it's tough. It's difficult. It's hard to convince, you know, people like what we're trying to do here is we want to be respectful, but we want to address like what kids are going through and what they're thinking about. And I had just seen, going back to your question, sorry, I just went off on a tangent there, but going back to your question about the impetus kind of the story was I had watched some stuff on YouTube actually of kids doing these, active shooter drills in schools, and various states are trying to implement them in different ways. And I mean, it's really early, I think, in the process. And, you know, it's like, God bless them for trying to do the best that they can do, but it's been a messy process. And kids are actually having, you know, like PTSD from some of these experiences in the school, and which is the training. So, and how to deal with the situation. So I was just kind of seeing like how kids were dealing with that. And I was reading some different stories about it, getting some feedback from teachers and stuff. And I was just like, I wanted to incorporate this into the story. But I also personally grew up around it, because I'm from California originally, but grew up really in Memphis, Tennessee. And, you know, my middle class kid and the friends of my, or the parents of my friends were educated, working, successful people. But, you know, the gun culture stuff is everywhere. And I had access to that everywhere, you know, all the time, from a very young age. And that's not necessarily in every little pocket of America, but it's all over the place. And I'm just, what I'm interested in is how that affects the developing psychology of a kid, because I think it's at a different level today than it once was. And I think that's kind of the conversation that we don't get to have, that sort of more nuanced conversation about like how kids perceive the whole situation.
Well, it's scary too, because if you'd like to live in a world where kids wouldn't have to have these discussions, you wouldn't have to have the drills to make people prepared for it. But in a really scary and sick way, I mean, you need to fight fire with fire. And the only way to fight fire is to know where the extinguishers are. So if you're able to sort of deal with it, it's terrible that it would become commonplace. I mean, you know, you have earthquake drills, you have fire drills, you have nuclear drills, now you have gun drills. But
sure, I mean, I grew up worrying about earthquake drills when I was a kid in California. I remember actually vividly remember being scared during an earthquake drill when I was about 6 or 7 years old in Northern California. We had just had a huge earthquake. I think it was like in 89 or 90 in Northern California. But then after a while they become routine, right? And you don't even think about it. By the time you're 12, 13, it's just like break time. I get to go walk outside and talk to my friend for 20 minutes before you get brought back inside. Yeah. But you know, with some of the active shooter drills and some of the stuff they're trying to implement in schools, well, this is kind of interesting. I was actually shocked as to how, you know, serious for my main character, Jacob Sandler is the actor's name. He actually played a young Brad Pitt in Ad Astra, a science fiction film called Ad Astra. I met him. And I mean, when the first time I met him, I just kind of knew right away. I mean, I know that sounds so cliche, but I saw a lot of kids, and he was probably the second or third kid I saw. And after that, it was just like, did I measure up to Jacob? You know, he just had a kind of, he had a kind of confidence, but he had a sort of like just a kind of understanding of what we were trying to do from the get-go, which I found kind of shocking because he was 12 years old at the time. And he just took this sort of, he had this seriousness about this subject matter. And listen, when I was 12 or 13 years old, this was right before Columbine happened. Would have been, well, a couple of years maybe before Columbine happened. And, you know, if I think it'd be very difficult to talk to kids at that age at that time about the subject matter. But now today it's like they're so used to hearing about it that they just kind of go into this like sort of mode, this subdued kind of mode about it when you bring up the subject. And it's kind of heartbreaking. It's saddening. It's you know, they're brave, but at the same time, you just wish that we just didn't even have to talk about it, you know? So the short film was really just a piece, you know, it was about just making a kind of art imitating life sort of thing.
I wrote a 40-page treatment. Well, treatment's probably the wrong word terminology wise, but I wrote 40 pages of an idea, and trying to stretch that to 100, 115 to sort of find where it was going to go was very difficult. When you make a short, you know, you can be, there's a purpose to being dense and concentrated. how did you feel about the runtime?
Yeah, it's interesting because, well, one thing you consider when you make a short film, I mean, you want as many people to see it as possible, obviously. And that means, you know, you have a robust festival run, if you're lucky enough to have a robust festival run. And that in itself takes considerable resources and time and so forth. And the festivals really have a hard time programming longer films, because obviously if they're programming 20, 25 minute short films, you know, they can only program so many. So you're better off kind of going with just a tight, well-constructed script as you can possibly, you can't, because of course the goal is for as many people to see it as possible. I would, you know, my particular, the subject matter of the story, I mean, my first draft of the script was 30 pages. And I mean, that would mean a 30 minute movie, hypothetically. So way too long, right? This short's 15 minutes, which for me is just incredibly short. I've written a few features. They're all, you know, 120, 130 pages. And, you know, that's roughly two hour movie, depending on how long winded you get with some of the shots and the takes and stuff. But, I always find in the end that my wife is actually my editor, and she's an accomplished commercial editor. She's edited a couple features and stuff as well. She actually just did a Super Bowl commercial. And I mean, you know, like any good editor will tell you, just, you know, you want to take away and strip it down as much as possible and then kind of build it up and, you know, dabble in some of the unusual takes or things that go in the direction and place that you didn't think you would normally, but you first need to construct a really tight sequence. And I think from the beginning, it was just like, I didn't want a ton of dialogue. I didn't want too many scene locations. Although I think this short in particular has kind of a lot of variety in terms of the kids, like, you know, daily life. You know, he's at the house, he's in the park, he's at the school, he's at, you know, we tried to put as much in there as we could, given the window of time that we had to work with. Yeah, it's kind of a, you know, it's an atmospheric, intended to be kind of an atmospheric piece, you know, not a dialogue heavy piece, hence the 15 minute runtime.
And also one of the things that maybe the strength of the film is that the exposition came from things that in the beginning you hear about weapons or gun vernacular in sports technology, or, you know, how commonplace video games are. So you're sort of inferring or hinting at, you know, it's all around us. It's just, unfortunately, sometimes it finds it into the wrong places, like a school. But what I really found myself drawn to is the visuals. There's this sort of impossible zoom shot that you did. It looks kind of like a 70s hilltop shot into the mountain. I'm just wondering how far, is this, how do you do the zoom? Oh, it's a drone, but it's sensational, just like the visuals sing.
Oh, thank you. I have a totally unhealthy obsession with, like, you know, like 60s and 70s European cinema, a lot of Italian cinema. And you see that zoom all over the place, and it could be used in, you know, in the wrong way, but in that particular, the way it's used in that film, I just was saving it for, like, that's when the kid makes a decision to pursue, you know, the acquisition of a gun. And I felt like that was a big moment. And so I just kind of went all in on that visually. And actually, when we were shooting that in real life, I mean, he was probably 100 yards away, at least, up in a hill, you know, I don't know, maybe 50 feet up, 100 yards away. And it was just like sheer luck that we got him in focus. I mean, we had to run it a few times, obviously, but I'm glad you noticed that, actually, because that was one of those director, you know, just where I kind of indulged myself, I guess. But yeah.
And then the music really did a lot. I mean, with the effectiveness of the travel scenes and the moody atmospheric electronic work, I mean, it really picks up around the 5 minute mark. Can you speak about working with the composer to come up with some great tracks?
Yeah. So the music was done by a man named Brandon Moeller. And we licensed the tracks from him. And we went through, I probably listened to, in the thousands of tracks, probably, of just a wide range of stuff. I knew there was a few moments where I'm like, okay, there's music here. And it needs to kind of help, you know, sell the tone and the mood of this particular scene or sequence. And it just, I landed on that. There was something about that music that made me feel tense and made me feel a bit of anxiety. And I felt like that was most true to what the characters were experiencing in that scene. So that's the kind of feel I went with it. But the film overall doesn't have a whole lot of music in it. Actually, the last track, the final song that you hear in closing is actually Jonathan Irwin, who plays Blake, plays the troubled teen in the film. That's actually him. He's a singer, guitar player, an extraordinary talent. And he's got that song. And I was like, man, I have to use this. You have to let me use this for the end of the film. And because, I mean, even the lyrical content of it, I just really worked. And so the final song you hear at the end credits was actually his. But
well, that's amazing. I didn't pick up on that. But leading up to that, there's an interesting juxtaposition. You've got a climactic scene towards the end, and it finds us, it's itself an odd juxtaposition to the credits. It's not often I find myself just my eyes popping out, but that scene at the end did it for me. Can you talk about maybe how the music and the cinematography,
the sound design? Oh yeah, yeah, sure.
All kind of
it's a. You know, Mike Bellevue is my sound designer, played a huge role in that and really helping me shape and build this kind of this really tense atmosphere. And of course, at that point, at the end of the final sequence, I don't want to give too much away, but we're in the head of the main character at that point, really. And much like we were discussing earlier, this is things kids are imagining, scenarios that could potentially happen in school. This is what kids are thinking about. So I wanted to create this kind of, it's fairly dark sounding. It's, you know, hopefully not too heavy handed at any point, just honest. And I felt like Mike, my sound designer, really helped me accomplish that, as well as Ryan Carmody, my DP, who I was very lucky to have him as well. And we wanted to, just kind of start with, in the beginning of that sequence, we're kind of with Wesley, the main character, and we hear some gunshots off in the distance, and Wesley, you know, runs into the school, into the hallway, and we're following him. And it's actually really the only time in the film that you see handheld. We snuck in some handheld shots, you know, elsewhere in the film, but at that point, it's really intentionally meant to look like handheld because it's, you know, things are off kilter at that point. You know, you're supposed to be kind of thrown off by what's going on, and I think that helped, you know, that and the music and coupled with the music, I think, or the sound design rather, really helped kind of build the tension in that scene and all that. And of course, comes to an end when we're at Wesley in his desk, and we realize this is kind of a dream sequence. A lot of times the dream sequences, I think, are used as a visual tool to throw a curveball at the audience, you know, to kind of, but this actually, in this case, it is the point. It's what he's thinking about. And we go back to him, and it's just like the bell rings. He's all smiles, back to being a kid again. And, you know, that's the end. So, did that answer your question anyway? I'm sorry.
No, I think it did, because I think the strength of that ending and everything leading up to it is nebulous, but it's also, like you said, it's not too heavy-handed, because you're not pointing a finger at a bad guy. You know, it's a story, fanciful, based in fact. And I think it's just, you know, visually, sound wise, and just narrative, there's so much strength happening. It's phenomenal work.
Thank you.
But moving forward, or as anybody who might be pursuing the short film endeavors, what's the market for a short film, and how do you take things through its paces to get the most eyes on it?
That's a great question. You know, that is something that is, I think, you have to constantly be learning. I am still constantly learning, because the process has changed so much. Even since going back to the first short film I made, which was in 2010, I actually almost got a feature film off the ground when I was very, very young. And thankfully, it did not happen, because I don't think I would have been ready at the time. But it was kind of a timing thing. And I almost got it done, didn't happen. And was like, with some of the same people, it was like, let's just go make a short. And, even since that time, short filmmaking has changed dramatically. I feel like, you know, short films today are actually more important than ever. 10 years ago, if you had a short film that was shot on like super 16 millimeter, especially 35 millimeter or something like that, was like you had already reached some level of legitimacy. You had used all the industry standard gear, and you had a full-size production crew and all that stuff. And now it's like, you know, people are making films with their iPhones, they're putting them on YouTube, and people make clips and they get, you know, tens of millions of hits on YouTube and stuff. But still, like, the fully realized narrative short film, I still think serves a purpose, because there are so many festivals out there. You don't have to just be at Sundance or Tribeca. There's lots of festivals, international festivals, where you can get, achieve some, you know, visibility. And there is kind of a market. I mean, you know, the, for example, a short film that won an Oscar last night, Two Distant Strangers. It was, I think it was one of the most viewed, not just shorts, but films on Netflix last month or something. Netflix acquired the short. And this was, this may have been before they got their Oscar nomination, I'm not sure. But anyway, I mean, there is, you know, as far as the distribution of a short film, I don't know, you know, if you're asking about, like, how do you monetize a short film? I think that's a whole...
I'm just asking kind of like, because I've been at many festivals. Dallas has an international film festival. Austin, of course, has fantastic. And so I'm just curious, how do you get on the circuit and you know, things like that?
Yeah, I mean, we started, I think our first film festival for Wesley was back in November. And due to COVID, it's just been all online. So that's been unfortunate. We've been lucky enough to been at a couple of great film festivals. We won Best Short International at Manchester Film Festival in the UK. And it's a great international festival, amazing venue and stuff. And of course, that was all online due to COVID. And then this week it's at Beverly Hills Film Festival, which great venues. I mean, the WGA, the Writers Guild building is one of the venues. The Grauman's Chinese is one of the venues. And none of that's happening, obviously, because of COVID. So it's just online. So as far as, like, just how to get onto it, I mean, to give them a plug, I promise I'm not, like, paid by them or anything like that. But Film Freeway was a great resource. They've got a huge list of film festivals, and you can get great reviews by filmmakers, you know. And you know, some of these film festivals, if you never heard of them, I mean, they don't have to be in a major city. Give them a chance, because thousands of people might tune in to check it out. And I think ultimately, you know, the end game is to try to get it out there on a streamer, if we're lucky enough to do that. And if not, we'll release it, you know, on the internet. You know, short filmmaking, I think it's really just, there's something that's honest and kind of pure about it, because it's not corrupted by any real, you know, money or anything that it, that would, you need to cast this person because this financier said this or that or whatever. I mean, all that stuff's out the window with a short film, I think, in most cases. And I think that makes, for that reason, it's a really great medium for a filmmaker that's coming, you know, an up and comer that just wants to, you know, do the best work that they can possibly do with limited interference.
And I imagine with your work with music videos, and again, the visual strength of this, it's like, I think you're going to be, your trajectory is climbing, Travis.
Hey, I hope so, man.
Need some flattery.
I hope so. Yeah.
But, you know, interesting thing is, sometimes depending on the short or depending on the filmmaker, shorts are either maybe like a test, you know, what do you call it? Not test fit.
Like a calling card?
Yeah, kind of. One of my favorite ones in the past couple of years has been by an Australian duo, Jonathan and Josh Baker. They did Bagman, which lives on.
I've never seen it, but I know Bagman. I know the name. Yeah.
Okay.
I know the name. Yeah.
Well, in a roundabout way, it turned into a feature film a couple of years ago. They, Lionsgate made it into a feature, and it's actually, there's some DNA that, you know, found its way into the feature, but not the entire thing. So it's not exactly a proven ground. I guess that's the word I was trying to say, or maybe sizzle reel or something. But do you feel like any of your shorts, whether it was the one that you don't want anybody to see,
or yeah,
you want to do more feature work?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely, I have something in mind. I have a treatment for this short film, for a feature version of it, but it's not really the same plot, but a lot of the same themes. So I wouldn't say it's, you know, I wouldn't say, like, you know, this is baby Wesley and I want to make, you know, a big adult feature film Wesley. It's more, it's kind of the same themes. It's a lot of different perspectives, and it's, you know, doesn't really adhere to just this plot, but it's kind of in the same world kind of thing. So yeah, there is that. And for that reason, I think, you know, I hope that the short would serve some purpose there in getting that made, the feature version.
Okay. Well, I guess my last question is, you know, you say you have the help of your wife, who is an in-house editor, so to speak. And over the years, you've sort of got a corral of friends and confidants. You mentioned before about being in the short film circuit, it's a labor of love. But you know, when you, in certain industries, if you need, say, a coder or you need an architect, you'll call up a temp agency or staffing. How do you find resources for a short film or feature film?
The World Wide Web. In one department, I would have access to some great talent, some people I knew or a friend of a friend that would be interested in doing it, wanted to check out the script. And then, like, for example, Ryan, who was the cinematographer, he literally had just shot something for Michael Bay, a commercial for Michael Bay, like a week before he did our short. And I mean, mega talent, this guy, as a DP, and he brought so much to the film. And I was lucky to have him. But in other cases, you know, I had like an open spot where I was just kind of using, you know, some of the websites you use when you're living in Los Angeles to cast. I mean, I think I even did at one point, I did a Craigslist post for a crew position. You know, I interviewed a lot of people, but, you know, I mean, my producing partner, John Brewer, and I mean, you know, between the two of us, you know, over the last years, I've just, you know, been lucky enough to meet some great people. And even if it's maybe your first or second choice is not available, someone's also like, well, I know this person who might be really interested in this. And I would hope that people, you know, if you're making a short film, it's not like you're making a lot of money or anything. You know, so even if you're a department head, I think you've got to really be kind of a believer of the subject matter. And I mean, it's really got to be a central motive, I think, because you're going to work long hours and it's going to be, you know, you're not going to have an hour lunch, you know, every day and all that stuff. I mean, you just, you know, it's very demanding of all the people working on it. So you just don't have all the extra little things that you would have on a bigger production. But yeah, we did, like, for the cast. I mean, I used Casting Frontier or LA Casting. Both are Casting Frontier and LA Casting, both, like, you know, websites. Did some posts there, and I was very lucky to meet, I think I met a few of my actors through those services. And then one of the other ones, you know, we used a couple of agency contacts that we had to find some people. So it was sort of a mixed bag. It was like, you know, some kind of DIY, there was some like DIY stuff happening. And then there were some like strong connections we had with some people just from experience working with some different folks.
Okay. Well, no, that's great. That's great to see that there's so many possibilities out there. I remember talking to Benson and Moorhead when they were working on, I think it was VHS Viral. Their sequence,
oh, cool,
in that movie, and they were trying to find some skaters, so they, you know, did like a Craigslist, and like, how awkward is that to type, what are you looking for, men for men? I don't really know.
Yeah.
Conversation's yeah, gonna go, but.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, when you do one of these casting things, especially in a place like LA, and I'm sure you'd have a huge turnout in Dallas as well, really any city, because there are actors, there are people that want to be in this industry, that want to, they're artists, you know, in every city in America, but especially LA. I mean, if you do like an open casting call or something, I mean, I learned, because it had been a while since I had done a casting. The last one I had done, I think, was for a commercial like a year and a half ago that I was sort of quarterbacking. But on this one, I guess it was a little too vague. You know, it was like age, you know, 12 to 16, any race, any, you know, male, it was like a huge, you know, swath of people showed up, and I really had to like fine tune everything and kind of narrow it down. Yeah, there are a lot of resources out there, but it's trial and error for sure, you know.
Gotcha. Well, good luck with the film festival this weekend. I hope you get a lot of eyes on it. And if you could tell our listeners where to find you and any plans you have for the rest of the year.
Yeah, well, Wesley's going to be playing at Beverly Hills Film Festival. You can check them out online. I think it's showing on Friday. So if you buy a ticket for that, you get like a whole block of films, some documentaries and stuff. You'll have access to a number of films, which is really cool. It's a great festival, and there's going to be a lot of great stuff there. My website's travisandrade.com, and wesleyfilm.com is one you should definitely check out for the trailer for the short, and some information about where I'll be showing in the future. And as far as my plans this year, I mean, I'm just working and developing stuff. And, you know, my wife and I have a post company. We're doing, you know, do some editing of some commercials and stuff, but also writing and and developing some of my scripts. So hope to make a feature next. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, look forward to that. And I will put all that stuff in the bottom of this post. Well, thank you, Travis, for your time, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much. Take care.